Recording started.
Hello and welcome to the November 2012 edition of the Internet Storm Center's monthly threat update. My name is Johannes Ulrich and I am today actually here in San Diego, California for our SANS event here. So this is the reason why we record this a little bit earlier than normal on Wednesday. We will still have the recording available at the normal time, so sorry if you listen to this as a recording, you'll still get the same presentation as you would usually get. Would also like to thank our sponsor again, Core Security. Core Security is making this webcast possible each month, of course, and they're not going to take any time away from us here by giving their little spiel. It's just would like to be acknowledged. We have two parts to today's webcast. First, as usual, we'll start out with Microsoft patches. Probably you know by now we got six of them. Nothing overly exciting here. And in the second part, I'll talk about an idea, a network a traffic whitelisting. It's based on a talk I gave recently in at our Vegas conference a couple of months ago, and just want to present sort of a quick summary of this here. We'll have about sort of half an hour, 40 minutes, so let's see how far we get with the network traffic whitelisting. A good part of this will be a demo. So anyway, let's start with our Microsoft patch summary for this month. Six patches, as I stated. Some old favorites, like we do have an Explorer patch, the Office or Excel patch. This is very much a standard fare. The other things are a little bit different, and I probably will spend a bit extra minutes here. But like I said, nothing really too different. One thing, of course, that was publicized heavy in this patch set is that this is the first normal patch set for Windows 8 and Windows RT. So some of these patches do apply to Windows RT, like this first one. And the first one is really just your standard cumulative security update for an Explorer. We have that most months. Actually, last couple of months, I think they didn't have it. They had one out-of-band one for InExplorer, and it was also implemented as a cumulative security update. And, of course, they're called cumulative because they do include prior patches, so it's not that you have to apply all the individual InExplorer patches. You may just go ahead and apply this one if you're on a new system. Three vulnerabilities patched here. Like I said, no exploit, actually, for any of them. At this point, at least. Next one, the Windows Shell remote code execution. This one affects an interesting feature I wasn't actually that familiar with. I'm not a big Windows person, and this affects the briefcase feature. Now, the briefcase feature allows you to sync folders between different hosts. So what you can do is you mark essentially your setup folder as a briefcase on different systems of yours, and it's automatically synced, and you can use USB sticks to sync them or the network. Now, in order to exploit this vulnerability, the user just has to open a malicious briefcase in their Windows Explorer, so not in an Explorer, just in the Windows File Explorer, and be subject to this particular vulnerability. This is why Microsoft labeled it critical. Like, you know, Microsoft is always a little bit picky on labeling stuff critical if it requires user interaction, but in this case, there's really no user interaction per se required other than looking at the folder. folder, so you don't have to open a document or anything. This is why it is considered critical. These briefcases could be hosted on network shares, and one exploit scenario that Microsoft points out here is where someone would connect to a network share that's not properly secured, where then an attacker would be able to actually upload a briefcase to this network share. Next one is an information share, information server. And we usually know it as a web server, but it's also an FTP server. And that's in part the component that has an issue here. There are two information leaks here. The first one affects how logging is done, where in certain cases passwords may be logged in clear text, which of course is then a problem if someone gets a hold at the passwords. I always point out that as a system administrator, you never really want to be able to see your user's passwords. So this is kind of why it is a problem, even if your logs are installed. Essentially, what you're kind of losing here is sort of repudiation, where where you can no longer prove that the user is actually responsible for an action because an administrator could have seen the user's password. So this is the first part here. The second part is another information leakage issue, and it again affects the FTP part of IIS. The problem here is that IIS allows you to run FTP over SSL using this TLS mechanism. Now, what may happen here is that some of the FTP commands are being sent before the TLS tunnel is established, so they're actually then leaking out in the clear. Microsoft rates this as moderate. We agree with this. Of course, this one doesn't apply to the ISC to the client. It's only a server issue. Next, the .NET framework. This one is a little bit of a tricky one. You really have to see what will happen with it. It has a number of different components, this particular patch. That's why I just labeled here several CVE numbers. I didn't really want to list them all here. But just sort of highlights. The first one, this code access security, that's a feature in .NET that essentially allows you to limit what the .NET code can do, and this vulnerability allows bypass of these limitations. So in essence, your code would be able to do more than it's supposed to, which then of course can be used to make vulnerabilities in .NET code burst. Now, there's also sort of an arbitrary remote code execution capability here that does require the user to actually then access a .NET application that's vulnerable. And then we have an insecure library loading vulnerability. These just don't go away, it looks like. I think it was about 2 years ago when this problem was originally kind of disclosed. The issue here is still the same, that an attacker could provide a malicious DLL file, put it on an insecure file share or something like that, and then if you load your software from that particular directory while your current path is that remote share, then your software may load the malicious DLL if the normal DLL is not available. And then we had these, like I said, over the last 2 years in various different software packages that are vulnerable to this issue. The next one I think is probably the most critical one in my opinion here from this patch set, and that's a kernel mode driver remote code execution. Now, we typically do have some kernel mode driver vulnerability each month, but most of the time they're local privilege escalation vulnerabilities. So the user needs to have proper credentials to actually trigger them. The reason I consider them really important is because these kernel mode drivers do run as system. So anybody exploiting one of these vulnerabilities would not just be the user that opened whatever document you're talking about here, but would actually have full control to the system. Now, in this part here, the particular bad ones, like again, there are three different vulnerabilities here, but the most dangerous one, in my opinion here, is the TrueType font library parsing vulnerability. One of these kernel mode drivers is responsible for parsing through type fonts, and if you load a malicious font, which may happen automatically, if you go to a website, websites have the ability to offer you fonts that your browser may automatically download in order to render the page correctly. If one of these fonts is malicious, this could then trigger the remote code execution vulnerability, and then, you know, of course, with kernel mode drivers may be used to gain full access to the system. We had a TrueType font library vulnerabilities in the past. There are exploits for this class of vulnerabilities. Don't think there's one for this particular vulnerability yet, but this is the one that I'm really the most concerned about at this point. If there are already past vulnerabilities for similar, past exploits for similar vulnerabilities, there may be some code that people can borrow to exploit this one relatively quickly. And then finally, I guess every patch set has to have some kind of office component to it. We have a couple of vulnerabilities here in Excel. These are your standard Office vulnerabilities. Also affects Office or Excel for the Mac. So if your Mac users also have to attach this one. But then again, it's just yet another sort of Excel Office vulnerability. Now, here the patch priority. I have seen a lot of people recommend the Internet Explorer patch first. I don't have a strong preference. The reason I put the kernel mode drivers one first is because it has the potential of a full system compromise, not just a compromise as the user. Neither for the Internet Explorer nor for the kernel mode drivers, I believe, is there's a current exploit for them. However, you know, either one is probably going to come up pretty soon as an exploit, given sort of past history, essentially. Then as third one, I put the Excel vulnerability in here. Again, you know, just because these are very popular vulnerabilities to be exploited and lots of history to draw from to write this exploit. The Windows Shell one, I put last year out of the client remote execution vulnerabilities, just because I think that's a little bit more obscure to actually exploit. You do need to have access to the shared drive or something like this to actually exploit that. So I'm less concerned about this one. The .NET one, .NET framework one, then next to last and last. The IIS one, just because it is really not that important, the kind of information leaks that you get there, but certainly something you want to patch. And of course, the last one, the IIS one, is the only one that really applies to servers here. The .NET one, you probably also want to patch on your servers pretty quickly. But those last two ones are really only sort of are mostly for servers. Overall, with the patch priority, of course, it always depends on what you're seeing in your environment. Now, we had some report of issues with this patch that haven't nailed it down to one particular patch yet. On our website, the diary that discusses this particular the Windows patches has some comments from users that had issues with these patches. The symptom you'll see is you'll have a little balloon pop up in the lower left-hand corner of your screen telling you there's additional information required to connect to the Internet. The normal reason for this balloon is if you have a network connection, you have an IP address, but your system can't connect to the outside world because, for example, there's some kind of captive portal or something like this. You have to log in first. But what happens apparently is that these balloons sort of pile up and make that system somewhat unusable. Like I said, there is a knowledge base article actually from Microsoft that speaks to that and that you may want to refer to if you see this problem. But and by the way, if you do see this problem, let us know. We're trying to get a little bit of a hand on how many people are affected by this issue. But anyway, this is the Microsoft patch set for this month. So like I said, they're nothing terribly exciting. Actually, by the way, it looks like Microsoft this year will stay with two-digit patch numbers. Last year, if you remember, went above 100. Now, this is the next-to-last patch set for the year, and we're only at 76. I doubt that Microsoft will have 25 patches for December. Anyway, let's sort of now move on to sort of the topic of the month. This month, we did have a lot of sort of the standard fare, didn't really have a lot of very special things for the month. So I figured let's talk about this topic of network traffic whitelisting, which is something I got a bit interested in, trying to find ways to do that better. And whitelisting is not a new idea. It has really sort of started to catch on in the software world. You know, we have more and more software whitelisting tools that are being used in addition or instead of antivirus. And here's a quote from Marcus Ranham that I think puts down the problem quite well. He published this a few years back. I forgot what the exact date was, but here as one of his six dumbest ideas in InfoSec. And what he's stating here essentially is there is so much badness out there. Trying to come up with a dictionary of all the bad things is really kind of a futile exercise. You're much better off just listing everything that's good. And you know, like I said, the software whitelisting, that certainly has proven to be true. On your system, you have a couple thousand of well-known binaries that you need to run the system, and it's not that hard to set up hashes of all these binaries and make sure they don't change. Way back in the days, you know, software like Tripwire probably was the first kind of implementation of that idea. Now, Tripwire, if you ever used it, tends to be a little bit clumsy and quite a bit of work to actually get going. But these days, in particular, if it comes sort of to detecting malicious and abnormal binaries, we have tools like, you know, Bit9 and such that do a real good job in cataloging all the good, benign software on a system, and then alerting you if you have anything on your system that's not in its dictionary of benign software. So the part where it really hasn't caught on yet, and where it has really proven to be quite difficult, is network traffic. With network traffic, we really still, for a large part, rely on plat lists and signatures. If you think about how IDSs work, one of the big problems people have with IDSs is to keep those signatures updated, very much like in the antivirus world. Remember, you only have signatures for known bad attacks. So if you look back a couple of weeks, there was a paper that looked at some of the advanced persistent threat attacks and such, where they essentially found that exploits are being used in the wild several months before they are publicly disclosed, and you wouldn't really have a signature for them either in your IDS or as part of your antivirus software. And that's where whitelisting would be a nice idea. But you know, whitelisting has some real problems when it comes to network traffic. If you think about you know, how whitelisting is done for software, we essentially calculate hashes for all the software on the system. with network traffic, you have a much harder time applying this. You cannot really apply hashes for all good network packets. The variety of network packets is just too large for that. So this is really one of the issues here. But then again, if you can't explain, if you don't really know what's a network, that also kind of shows that you don't really have control of your network and the systems that are actually using your network. And that's sort of why it should work. You know, hopefully, what kind of systems are connected to your network. And you know what software is installed on these systems. And you know who's using these systems and what they're supposed to do with these systems. You have some business processes that are defined. So really you have all the input that kind of defines what network traffic you should see. But still, it turns out to be a real hard problem to do whitelisting on network traffic. And to demonstrate a little bit the problem that you're having with whitelisting network traffic, I want to do a little bit of a demo here and run an experiment. And this is something that I highly recommend you do occasionally on your networks. Once a week, once a month, depending on how much time you have, collect some traffic on your network and essentially go through it and try to explain what the traffic is about. So what I did in this example, I took an idle system, and I do recommend that you start with something simple like that. And I fired up tcpdump on the idle system. It wasn't a switch network. I didn't do anything fancy trying to collect more traffic than the system would normally receive. So just fired up tcpdump on an idle system and collected traffic. I collected it here for an hour. Last time I actually did it, it only took 10 minutes. Really depends on your system. Don't get too much traffic. I find a couple megabytes is sort of just about what you want. Maybe less. It's actually better to have less traffic than too much. So here I fired up on this idle iMac, and there was no user logged in into the system other than me remotely via SSH. It's a normal home network. I did it here on my home network so I can show you the traffic. Didn't really want to have any sort of privacy issues and such. And so the only thing you see is traffic to and from the system, you know, no off spoofing or anything. And so that's why I kind of recommend, you know, fire up tcpdump on a system. You know, idle is, in the beginning at least, better than a busy system. But then you can vary it. Let's just, you know, collect a couple megabytes of traffic. It may only take a couple minutes, may take, like in this case, about an hour to collect that amount of traffic, and then just try to analyze it. First thing I looked at was the traffic volume, and here it's sort of in bits per minute, so there's really not a lot of traffic happening on this system. There are a couple spikes, a couple connections that are sort of happening here, but other than that, you know, it should be pretty boring, yeah? So let's see what we have. Now, the way you usually work this is you sort of work your way up the stack. And here it just looked at layer 2, layer 3 stuff. Essentially what I did here is I summarized the Ethernet types. Your Ethernet header has your MAC address and also has a type which tells you, well, you know, what's the next header or what's going on in that Ethernet packet. And I found only 4 different types. The last 3 are kind of obvious, no ARP traffic. I do have some IPv6 traffic, I do have some IPv4 traffic. And the one that's a little bit odd here, this LLDP traffic. Now, that's another part of this exercise. What you will run into is odd stuff like this, you know, like here this LLDP. Now, turns out that this is link layer discovery protocol. The switches I'm using on my network, I have them configured to send out these discovery protocol packets. These are Netgear switches. Netgear sort of has its LDP in Cisco networks. You may have the Cisco discovery protocol that has a very similar feature. Makes it easy to identify what switch port you're connected to and such. So that's what these packets are about. We really don't expect anything malicious, and you won't really see much malicious stuff. But you what we try to do is explain what's normal on our network. And you know, that's why sort of an idle host is a real nice way to start out with, because really you shouldn't see anything, but we all know that our hosts, even if they're idle, are constantly sending and receiving traffic. Next, we sort of work our way up in the stack, as I said, and then I have it here for IPv4 and IPv6 split out. IPv4, pretty standard stuff. We have some ICMP traffic, not a lot, you know, it's really just sort of this little sliver here, it's hard to see, actually. We have some IGMP traffic, as a multicast, UDP, and TCP, big bunch here of TCP is really the biggest slice. IPv6, similar picture, you know, some UDP, TCP, about half the traffic is UDP and TCP. The rest is ICMP, and then we have some hop-by-hop headers here. The hop-by-hop headers are somewhat interesting. What I usually do with this is I look at it, and then you know, I start diving into deeper in the traffic I'm not that familiar with. You know? ICMP, TCP, UDP, standard fare, expect that. Here, actually, this is the UDP traffic here. It's a really large chunk, about a third of the traffic. That's a hop by hop. That's the hop by hop traffic. So about a third of traffic is hop by hop, and definitely want to take a look at and see what's going on. You know, what is this hop by hop header, and what does it do? So one way to look at it is here with TCP dump. We filter out IPv6 and protocol 0. And here's one of the packets we get, but they're pretty much very similar. What you have here is multicast listener discovery. This is essentially IGMP, but in IPv6. In IPv6, we no longer use IGMP. Instead, we use these router alerts. Actually, the next header option here is a router alert. And telling the router, hey, we have an ICMP packet embedded here, and that's the multicast listener protocol. With that, let me switch over to the demo here and take a closer look at this particular traffic and some of the other traffic. Let me just give a second here to try and switch over. See if I got the right region here. Yeah, got it pretty closely. So close this window. We don't want this. So here I have a Wireshark and a T-Shark. For T-Shark, I'm actually here SSHing to my laptop. It's a bit easier than running a T-Shark on the Windows system I'm at here. But here we have our Wireshark. That's the traffic I just had. So let's look at all the traffic, and then let's find these hop-by-hop packets. The way I usually write these filters is I find some traffic that's close. Here I have some IPv6 traffic. I'm diving into my IP header. Then I'm finding here the next header field. Now here the next header field is ICMP v6, and that's not really what we want, but I do apply as filter selected. So this is next header 3A, but what we really want is 0, so let me switch to 0. And here we have these multicast listener query packets. And let me just open up the medium pane here so you can kind of see what that packet looks like. And let me actually use the full window here. So anyway, hope this is refreshing well for you, but you should see a Wireshark window here. At the very top, I just closed that top pane to only show the one packet we are looking at. And here you have sort of a real neat kind of IPv6 packet. We do have our IPv6 header. So it's IP version 6. Then we have our sort of standard fare here for the IPv6 header. But then the next header field is a hop by hop header. So the next header is a hop by hop header. And then after the hop by hop header, we have our ICMPv6 header. So that's why this is really I'm not sure. I get a. Anybody seeing the screen share here? Just got one user saying that you don't see the screen share. No screen share. Let me try to turn it off and on again. Actually, let me try to share the application, not the region. Okay, let's try this again. So now you should see the Wireshark window here. Okay, it's up by here now. Good. Yeah. So anyway, this is the Wireshark window. And like I said, you do have the IPv6 header. It sort of starts up here, ends here with destination IP. Then you have the hop-by-hop header. And then we have an ICMP header. And that's normal IPv6 traffic. Like I said, this is a multicast listener report here. In IPv4, this would be IGMP traffic. The IP addresses are a little bit interesting here in terms that the destination address is a multicast address. But it's actually sort of an interesting multicast address. If you look at the last three bytes of that multicast address, they're identical to the last three bytes of the source address. This address is referred to in IPv6 as a solicited multicast address. Any host in IPv6 listens on a multicast group where the last three bytes are identical to the host's IPv6 address. These addresses are kind of used for things like neighbor discovery, the ARP replacement. You really kind of replace sort of a protocol that used to be broadcast or multicast with something that's closer to unicast. Even though this is formally a multicast address, there's really only one host listening on it. And the odd part here, it's sort of sending it essentially to itself. Just kind of trying to figure out anybody else here, you know, with my MAC address or my IP address on the network. That's kind of, you know, what this is for. You know, it's similar to sort of a gratuitous ARP or something like this that you would see in IPv4. So we have a bunch of different ones like that here. No need to really go through all of them. But let's look at how we can sort of possibly summarize traffic. And with that, let me switch. Actually, let me first do this here with Wireshark before I switch forth and back. Let me clear the filter. So this essentially explains this hop-by-hop traffic. Another kind of traffic, of course, we sort of want to look at is all the TCP connections we have. Now, in Wireshark, one way we can look at this is we use the statistics, the conversation view here. Then we click on TCP. And one thing that's always kind of interesting is to look at our top talkers. So I am summarizing here by number of bytes. And here my top connection is an HTTPS connection. Like I said, you're talking about an idle host. Let's just follow the stream here. And of course, this is HTTPS. Yeah. I don't see much here. And there's really not much I can do with this. If I would have captured the initial beginning of the connection, I may have seen like a certificate here that would have told me more about the host name and such. Here in this case, I didn't get that. So the only option you have here is try to figure out more about the IP address. So with that, let me switch applications and go back to the shell. Let me try to share a region again here. Okay, let me give it a couple seconds for everybody to refresh. The IP address we have here is 50.93.246.173. And let's see, doesn't reverse resolve. And doing a whois on it. See what comes back. Code 42. I happen to know that this is sort of a con delivery network, and it is okay, but you know, this is already kind of a spot where we have absolutely no idea whether or not this traffic is malicious or not. It is HTTPS, so we can't really look at the payload. I could, if I'm still collecting, check what software is connecting to this IP address, but this was a while ago. If I look at it now, it's probably gone, unless I'm lucky and there's a new connection to that IP address. But let's take a look. Actually, I am lucky here, and there is a new connection. So now I could check what software is actually connecting here. Oops, I'm on OS 10. The P switch doesn't work. I need to do it with LS OS. Let's see if that gives me more hints here, but it can take a little while. You should have probably taken the, don't get anything back here. We'll have to play a little bit with this to really figure out what host is connecting outbound to that IP address. Could be my browser, but more likely something like an antivirus tool or something like this, or downloading new signatures. That's, I think, what it was last time I looked at it. But already we are having kind of issues with whitelisting here. Okay, so what you can do now here is just eliminate that stream and apply it again, or actually let's just go back to the statistics here, go to TCP again, oops, close some more conversations, TCP, and then move our way down. The next one here is an HTTP one, so that's a little bit more helpful. Let's take a look at this. Well, MacUpdate.com, I'm running this on a Mac, so this particular software is checking if there's new updates here available for my Mac. So this is something that's pretty easy, but like I said, this is also HTTP, which makes that a lot easier. So now you can go through this essentially one connection at a time. Let's see how many we have. I won't do this to you, and I won't go through all of them here, but with TCP, pick the wrong one again here, but anyway, you have a good number of connections here. There's a lot of short stuff, and that's also something you want to take a look at. Why is there only these short connections, 17 bytes, between these two internal hosts? Well, same game. We follow the stream and see what's happening. Well, this is an interesting bit of traffic, actually. A very short request. Definitely doesn't come from a normal browser. Response is kind of interesting. It has this auth server, and it has this JSON data here. Now, how do you work something like this? It's an internal network, so first thing, of course, you could do is check what IP addresses are involved here. The source, the 48, is my MAC here. 93, I happen to know that this is a thermostat, so that is one of those remote control thermostats, and this is sort of the MAC sort of polling that thermostat, and I guess it's 77.5 degree at that thermostat. But that's another thing you're learning while you're doing this kind of exercise on your network. You are learning more about your network. You figure out what devices you have on the network. Let's actually just look at the endpoints here. And if you look at the endpoints here on Ethernet, I have 65 endpoints here. So there are essentially 65 devices on the network here. And then I can check, well, what are those 65 devices? Now, some of these here are multicast addresses, so they don't really count. But Wireshark is nice enough to already resolve the OUI. So we have some Apple devices, of course, here, some Realtek, you know, it's a very common network card, some Netgear stuff, some odd ones, I have no idea, again, and whenever you see something, that's the goal here, whenever you see something odd, you know, what's Murata Ma? Well, apply as filter selective. Let's look at that traffic, and see what it's about. Yeah, this is this 93, this thermostat. I guess they do have an odd Ethernet UID here, OUI, that's being used by the Wi-Fi interface, that thermostat. And this is really what I want to show you here. Take some network traffic, sample it, and then find the odd stuff. Learn more about your network. Now, how does this help you with security? First of all, you will identify new protocols that you have on your network. The goal here is, you know that network map you have on your map, on your wall, you know, not half on your wall, half as a Visio file somewhere. It's probably one of the biggest lies in network security. It's never true. With this exercise, you'll be able to second-guess that network map. Figure out, is your change control process working? Are you updating that network map? And then, what are all these odd applications running on your systems? We sort of ran into one here, that thermostat, that was sort of odd and different. But and then even for some of the encrypted traffic, let me just filter here for SSH. Now, actually here, just right-click, follow TCP stream. Now, SSH is encrypted, but still, similar like with HTTPS, if you capture the beginning of the connection, you do see the unencrypted handshake. And then, for example, here, well, it's open SSH on both ends. If you have something like PuTTY, for example, as an SSH client, you would see PuTTY's banner here. Now, again, you now figure out what open SSH versions do we have running on our system, any out-of-date versions. So this is all the stuff that you can figure out if you're doing this exercise. And then you can actually write IDS rules for some of this as you discover interesting strings to look for. DNS traffic, that's something I always like to look at. Let's actually show a little exercise here how to summarize DNS traffic like this. So what we're looking for is DNS queries. Here I have a standard query. How do we look for queries? Well, we look essentially here for this flag being a standard query, 0100. Look at the lower left-hand corner, dns.flags. Remember that. dns.flags, 0x0100, so standard query. And then we would like to extract what we queried for. And that's DNS query name, if you look at the beginning. We can now use that and go into T-Shark. T-Shark, we read this traffic capture. We'll just do dash N to make it faster. With capital R in T-Shark, we can now write a query using a Wireshark filter. And, oops, sorry, that didn't mess it up too much for you. But let's go back here. It was dns.flags. So dns.flags equals, just like in Wireshark, 100. So this will get us all the DNS queries. I just limit the first 10 to not scroll it too badly for you. And then we want to extract the host name that's being requested here. The way we do this is dash capital T fields, And then dash E, what we want to exclude is DNS query name, if I remember correctly. Again, the field name according to Wirechart. And now we get all the host names we looked up. And then we can just do our standard sort of summarizing a list trick using Unix command line tools. I first sort the list, then I apply unique. I first have to sort it because unique will only compare lines that follow each other. I count it, that's a dash C, how many times something shows up, and then sort dash N to sort the result. And here I get a list of all of the names I look up. And I can go through there and see if there's anything off, you know, anything that shouldn't be there. I don't see anything here. FirstNet has antivirus updates. This is Mac update. You know, of course, Macs like to connect to iCloud, so I have some of that here, some connections to Google. So nothing really out of the ordinary here. But again, you learn more about your system. Who is it talking to? Now, what's all the information that kind of keeps sort of seeping out of your system? And again, this is an idle system. So all of this is just standard, normal crap that sits on your system and talks outbound. So what I want you to get out of this is do this yourself. Follow Dune exercise like this once a month, once a week. Collect some traffic, and in the end with this, learn more about your network. With this, well, we are sort of running up against our 45-minute limit. So I just want to put up here a final slide. I realize that many of you will record for this, will listen to the recording. So here's an email address to ask a question. There is a question here actually already from one listener about, is there a useful book for Wireshark and T-Shark? There is a good book. I forgot its name right now, but I think it is, go to the Wireshark site. I think the book is sort of now referenced on the Wireshark site and see what they recommend. And they show you some of this stuff too. I really like the combination of Wireshark and T-Shark. T-Shark itself can be a fairly obscure tool, in particular with the filter language, but using Wireshark to sort of work out what filter you want and what these field names are, and then just copy-paste that essentially into T-Shark, I think that's a very powerful and strong combination here. And actually, let me just go quickly to the site and see if I find that book while we're waiting for others. If anybody else has any questions, let me know. Yeah, I don't see it on the Wireshark site. Let me check Amazon if I can find the book. Yeah, do not get the practical packet analysis that comes up first when you pull up Wireshark. Or any of the exam prep guides. Here, this is, let me copy paste the title here into it. The title of the book is Wireshark and EtherReal. That book I liked last time I saw it. Maybe a little bit old by now. But I'm just posting the complete title into the chat window. Oops, sorry. So you should be able to see it, and you should be able to copy-paste that. Wireshark and EtherReal Network Protocol Analyzer Toolkit, Jay Beals Open Source Security. I remember that this book was pretty good. Any other questions? Well, if not, then thanks for listening, and also thanks to everybody listening to the recording, and talk to you again next month for the patch Tuesday update for our monthly thread update, actually. think it will be again the Wednesday after the patch Tuesday. And also, if you want a prefer sort of daily update, we do have the daily podcasts still. And I think today also we have a new oops out for the for some software security awareness. Now, there's another question here that just came in. That would be a good start point for network traffic analysis as far as study documentation. I would say, you know, the Wireshark website, the book I just posted, and then just do it, you know, play with it. Try to follow some of the examples I did here. That's how I sort of learned the most stuff, is by really just experimenting with it, seeing what works, what doesn't work. And that really kind of works the best. We do, of course, have Security 503, the Intrusion Detection In-Depth class, where we go over a lot of this stuff. But, you know, for something self-study that you can do at home, that's probably the best way to do it.